Stacks of cardboard boxes filled the closet completely, each one labeled clearly, Charlie, shirts and socks, Charlie, books, etc. At the very top of the stack was a long, flat box labeled, Charlie, Weird Experiment.
Weird Experiment. Feels like the story of my life these days, Carlton whispered.
He reached for it carefully, and had almost gotten it down when he knocked the corner against the box underneath it, sending Charlie Miscellaneous to the ground. The box split open, spewing out computer parts and random bolts and scraps of metal, fur, and two unattached paws. Three plastic eyes bounced as they hit the floor, then rolled across the carpet, clacking against each other merrily.
This is life or death. Someone else can clean it up, Carlton decided.
He stepped carefully over the rest of the mess and carried the box into Jessica's bedroom. He set it down on her bed, careful of the pale blue spread, and dragged the spare key across the packing tape to cut it. He opened the box.
Yikes!
He startled. Two identical faces stood upright in the box, staring at each other with blank eyes. They were like unfinished statues. They had features, but they were not refined, and seemed incapable of expression. He started to lift them out of the box, then realized that they were attached to something. With care, he managed to extract the entire structure, a large black box with knobs and buttons and the faces on their stand, wired to it. It all seemed to be intact. Carlton eyed the wall socket by Jessica's bed for a moment, then grabbed the cord and plugged the whole thing in. An array of lights came on, red and green, flashing on and off seemingly at random, then stabilizing, some off, some on. Several fans started to whir. Carlton looked at the faces. They were stretching, almost mimicking human movement.
Creepy, he whispered.
You, me, said the first, and he jumped back, disconcerted.
We, she, said the second.
He stared, waiting for more, but they were apparently finished for the moment, motionless and silent. Carlton shook his head, trying to make himself focus, though all he really wanted to do was sit here and watch the two faces, and see what else they might have to say. Or talk to them. He went back to the box. The earpieces John had described were wrapped up in a thin layer of bubble wrap. They looked like hearing aids, small clear pieces of plastic full of wiring with a tiny switch on one side. Carlton flipped the switch on one and put it in his ear. Instantly, the faces turned to him, tilting up like they were looking straight at him.
Can they see me?
Hi, Carlton said reluctantly.
Who?
One asked.
Carlton, he answered nervously.
You,
the other said.
Me, said the first.
You guys really love pronouns, huh?
Carlton said.
There was no answer from the faces.
He took out the earpiece and flipped the switch off, and simultaneously the faces turned back to each other.
Makes you visible.
Right, he thought with a shiver. He turned back to the earpiece itself, sliding his thumbnail into the thin seam that ran around the edge of the casing. It popped open easily, revealing a mess of wires and a tiny computer chip.
Just switch the wires, it's that easy, he muttered to himself.
There was a lamp on a nightstand beside Jessica's bed, and he turned it on, holding the earpiece under the light. He stared at it, looking for a clue as to what John had been suggesting, angling the tiny object from side to side. At last he spotted it, a single, empty, round input outlined in red.
"And why is nothing plugged into you?" Carlton said triumphantly.
He sorted through the other wires until he found one that matched it, the outline green. He quickly switched the wire to the red-lined plug and snapped the case back together, then switched it on and stuck it back in his ear. The faces did not move.
"What's wrong? Don't want to talk to me anymore?" he said loudly.
There was no response.
"Excellent," he said, satisfied.
He took out the earpiece and put it in his pocket, then grabbed the other one as well. He unplugged the experiment and was about to pack it back into the box when he felt a sudden prickling between his shoulders, as if someone was standing directly behind him. He could almost feel breath on his neck. Carlton held very still, scarcely breathing, then he spun around, his hands raised to defend himself. The room was empty. He flicked his eyes from side to side, unconvinced that he was alone, but there was nothing there.
"Just pack up and get out," he said weakly, but his heart was still pounding in his chest like he was fighting for his life.
He took a deep breath and went back to the experiment. Before he could touch it, the room dipped under him like a ship bobbing in the ocean, and he fell to his knees, clutching the bed frame to steady himself. His vision blurred. Nothing was fixed in place anymore. Everything in the room seemed like it was moving at various speeds in different directions. Carlton let go of the bed frame and sank to the floor as a piercing whine arose, quickly ascending to a pitch too high to perceive. He covered his ears, but it did nothing to ease the nausea. The room kept spinning, and his stomach lurched. He groaned, holding his head and closing his eyes, but the movement continued. He clenched his teeth, grimly determined not to vomit. What is happening?
"Carlton! Carlton!"
Someone called his name sweetly, and he looked. One thing in the room was still, an enormous pair of eyes, staring at him as the room rocked sickeningly. He tried to stand, but as soon as he moved, dizziness and nausea overwhelmed him. He pressed his cheek to the cool floor, desperate for relief, but it only made the room spin faster.
"Carlton?"
The room snapped back into focus. Everything stopped moving. Carlton didn't move, afraid of setting it all off again.
"Carlton, are you okay?"
said a familiar voice, and he looked up to see Charlie, bent over him anxiously.
"Charlie?" he said weakly. "What are you doing here?"
"John sent me to help. What were you doing with all this stuff?" she asked.
"I'm sorry. I hope I didn't break anything," he said, sitting up carefully.
The nausea still lingered, but it was easing as he began to trust that the room had steadied itself. He glanced at Charlie, his vision still a little fuzzy.
"I don't mind. It's all junk anyway. But the way you were rolling around on the floor, you must have activated something or electrocuted yourself, one or the other. Are you okay?"
"I think so," he said.
He slumped back against the bed.
"Nausea? Room spinning?" she asked sympathetically.
"Terrible," he said.
She put a hand on his shoulder.
"Come on, we need to get out of here."
She stood and held out a hand to help him up. He took it, standing gingerly. The effects of whatever it had been were almost completely gone. He looked around the room, his vision clear.
"What exactly were you doing?" Charlie asked, and Carlton froze.
Her voice was too hard, too polished. He turned to her, keeping his face neutral.
"He didn't say? John thought you might want to have it, your old experiment. I think he wanted to surprise you with it," he said.
He grinned.
"Surprise!"
Charlie smiled.
"You know,
Your old experiment? Carlton's mind raced. The one with the robotic hand that could play the piano? He added. You remember?
Right. How sweet of you to come get it, she said, a flirtatious note in her voice, and Carlton's blood went cold. He nodded carefully.
You know me, always thinking of others, he said, glancing over Charlie's shoulder at the bedroom door behind her. It was closed. She took a step closer to him, and he stepped back instinctively. She looked surprised for a moment, then grinned, looking down and seeing the two faces in the box. He moved back again, startling when he hit the wall behind him.
Carlton, if I didn't know better, I'd think you were afraid of me, Charlie said in a low voice, stepping so close there was almost no space between them, pinning him to the wall. She reached out toward his face, and he set his jaw, trying not to flinch. She ran her fingers down his cheek, then traced the line of his jaw. He didn't move, his breathing shallow. Charlie brushed his hair out of his face and pressed closer to him, trailing her hand to the back of his neck. Her face was inches from his.
Charlie, you're not really my type, you know? He managed to say. She smiled.
You haven't even given me a chance. Are you sure? She whispered.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, don't get me wrong, you're okay looking, but let's be honest, you're nothing to write home about. He quipped, maintaining eye contact. I mean, those boots with that skirt?
Charlie's grin started to wane.
Sorry, that was rude. I'm sure you'll find a guy someday who appreciates you for who you are.
He tried to inch his way toward the door.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm late for quartet practice, so let me just get by you and I'll be on my way.
Carlton squirmed, but Charlie didn't budge.
I promise I won't tell anyone that I rejected you. Just hit that gym and we can try again in a few years.
Carlton, you're obviously flustered. There's only one way to really be sure how you feel, Charlie said softly. She leaned closer, and Carlton screwed his eyes shut. The earpiece. It was in his right pocket.
Charlie, you're right, but maybe we should just talk for a while, you know? I rushed into my last relationship, and I almost ended up dead in a moldy fursuit.
Just distract her until... His fingers closed on the earpiece, and he pulled it from his pocket, opening his eyes at the same time. Carlton screamed. Charlie's face was splitting apart. Her skin had taken on a plastic cast. It was cracked at the middle, splintering into triangular sections. As he watched, her hand tightening around his neck, the triangles lifted up and pulled back like razor-edged flower petals, revealing an entirely different face, sleek and feminine, but definitely not human. The petals of what had been Charlie's face began to move along the round perimeter of the new face, beginning to look more like a saw blade than a flower. The animatronic girl pursed her metal lips, leaning in for a kiss as the blades spun closer and closer to Carlton's face. In a final burst of self-preservation, he yanked the earpiece out of his pocket and jammed it into his ear, flipping the switch. The animatronic girl drew back at once, letting go of Carlton's neck with a surprised look on her metal face. She glanced around the room. He stared at her, frozen in terror for a moment. Then he realized what was happening. She can't see me. He waited, watching as she took deliberate steps backward, her eyes darting back and forth. She stood for a moment, the plates of her face snapping back together to form the painted, glossy face of a doll. Then suddenly a ripple of light passed over her, and she appeared to be Charlie again,
her face expressionless. After another minute, she turned and went to the bedroom closet. She peered in, pushing clothes out of it as if something might be hidden behind them, then stepped away. She went to the bed and grabbed a corner, then lifted it off the ground. She considered the empty floor for a second, then let the bed drop with a crash. Once more, she scanned the room, and at last, she opened the door to the bedroom and let herself out. Carlton tiptoed behind her, following her into the hall. She stopped short in front of the hall closet, and he almost bumped into her, barely catching himself before they collided. The animatronic girl ripped the boxes from the neatly stacked closet, tossing them haphazardly on the ground behind her. Carlton cautiously stepped back a few feet. When the girl was satisfied the closet was unoccupied, she checked the bathroom, then walked out into the living room. With one last, dissatisfied glance around, the animatronic girl left Jessica's apartment, closing the door calmly behind her. Carlton rushed to the window, watching as she exited the building and walked away down the road, heading toward the town. Once she was out of sight, Carlton heaved a sigh, gasping as if he had been holding his breath. He felt dizzy again, lightheaded, but this time it was only fading adrenaline. He started to take the earpiece out, then thought better of it and left it in place. He patted his left pocket, reassuring himself that the second earpiece was still there, and he hurried out of the apartment and down to his car. He drove away urgently, heading toward John's house without regard for the speed limit, and hoping the animatronic girl was going the other direction. Charlie heard the door close, and she turned toward it. The room was dark except for the light filtering in through the small, dirty window, and she squinted to see who had just come in. "John?" she whispered.
"Yeah," he said in the same tone. "Did I wake you up?"
"It's okay. All I do lately is sleep and dream." The last word was bitter on her tongue, and he must have heard it too, because he sat down on the chair Marla had placed beside the bed.
"Is it okay if I sit?"
he asked nervously, already there. "Yes," she said. Charlie closed her eyes. The room was different now. Safer.
"You said something," she murmured, almost to herself, and John leaned closer.
"Did I? What did I say?"
He cleared his throat, his palms already sweating.
"You said you loved me," she whispered,
and he jolted as if someone had struck him.
"Yes,"
he said, his voice sounding choked off.
"That is what I said to you. You remembered that?"
Charlie nodded carefully, knowing her response was inadequate. He turned away from her for a second, letting out a forced breath.
"It's true, I do,"
he said in a rush, turning back to her.
"I mean, you've been my friend since forever. Just like Marla or Carlton or Jessica. I would have said that to any of them. Well, maybe not Jessica. So, you remember some of that night then?"
he asked briskly.
"It's all I remember. And the door. John!"
She grasped his arm, alarmed.
"John, the door was opening. I think Sammy was inside. I could feel him there, his heartbeat."
She trailed off as another memory overwhelmed her. A moment in the strange, artificial cave under the restaurant that was so like Freddy's, and yet so unlike it.
"Springtrap," she said. "I fought with him. There was a metal spike, and his head..."
She could see him, gasping on the rocks as she ground the piece of metal torturously into his wound.
"I know. I saw it too,"
John said, an uncomfortable shift in his eyes.
"He said, I didn't take him, I took you."
What?
John gave her a puzzled look, and she sighed in frustration. Sammy, I asked him why he took my brother from me, and that was what he said. I took you.
Well, you're here now. He's insane anyway.
John attempted a smile.
He probably just said it to hurt you, to confuse you.
Well, it worked. She let her head sink back onto the pillow. John, everyone's avoiding the question. How long has it been? I know it's been more than days, but how bad is it? A month?
He didn't answer.
2 months? She ventured. I know it can't be more than a year or you'd have a nicer apartment, she said weakly, and he winced. John, tell me, Charlie insisted, hearing her own voice rising, her heart beating faster as she waited for him to speak.
6 months, he said at last.
She didn't move. She could hear the blood rushing in her ears. Where have I been? She asked, her voice barely audible over the rushing sound.
Your Aunt Jen. You were with her. At least, I think that's where you were.
You think?
I'll tell you everything, Charlie, I promise. As soon as I understand it myself. There are things I just don't know, he finished helplessly.
She lay back, staring up at the ceiling. In the dim light, the stains looked like they could be decorative.
About your aunt, John went on, something awful in his voice. I saw her that night.
Charlie looked sharply at him.
That night? The building was coming down. You were inside, and I was trying to get to you, and she was just suddenly there. I don't know how she got in, or why.
It was her house, technically, Charlie said, turning back to the ceiling. Maybe she was there looking for me.
And that makes sense to you?
I don't know what makes sense, she said steadily. It doesn't make sense what I remember and what I don't remember. There's no one moment where suddenly it all goes blank. But I don't remember Aunt Jen being there.
Okay, he said.
I have to see her, Charlie said with sudden intensity. She's the only one who knows how all of the pieces fit. She's the one with all the secrets. She's always tried to protect me from them, but now, secrets aren't protecting anyone.
She stopped.
John looked stricken, his face stuck between expressions like he was afraid to move it. John? Charlie said, a knot forming in her stomach. John took a breath as if to speak, then hesitated. She could see he was searching for words. She gave them to him. She's dead, isn't she? Charlie said faintly. She felt like she was drifting off again, but she was not losing consciousness. John nodded.
I'm sorry, Charlie, he said hoarsely. I couldn't stop it.
Charlie looked back up at the stains. I should feel something, she thought. You need your head clear, she whispered, echoing her aunt's habitual reminder.
What?
John was watching her anxiously. Paperwork, she said more loudly. She kept files on everything, locked up in cabinets. Whatever she knew, she wrote it down, or someone else did. Where was she?
A house in Silver Reef, the ghost town, John stammered.
He looked taken aback.
There were files there, boxes of papers.
Then we have to go back there, Charlie said firmly. John looked as if he wanted to protest, but he just nodded.
She might go back there too, if she thinks you'll be there.
John shared a worried look. We have to go.
Then we go there, he said.
Charlie closed her eyes, the decision releasing her into sleepiness. The door opened, and dimly,
Charlie heard Marla and John whispering to each other. She took a deep breath, like she was going underwater, and let herself slip into the dark. Chapter 10.
Hey!
Something poked Jessica's shoulder, and she shrugged it away and rolled over, still half asleep.
Hey, you okay?
Something poked her cheek, much harder, and she opened her eyes and looked up to see a ring of children surrounding her, staring with wide eyes. Jessica screamed. Someone grabbed her from behind, covering her mouth, and she struggled to get away.
You have to be quiet,
a desperate voice whispered, and she turned to face a red-haired girl of about 7, looking at her anxiously.
If you're not quiet, it'll come get you,
she explained. Jessica sat up carefully and put a hand on her head. It felt like it was stuffed with cotton, and her sinuses were burning.
Not again.
Chloroform, or whatever that gas was.
What?
The girl asked.
Nothing,
Jessica said, looking at the frightened faces that surrounded her. There were 4 children in all, 2 boys and 2 girls. There was the young red-headed girl with freckles on her nose and a stocky African-American boy of about the same age who looked like he had been crying before she arrived. He was sitting cross-legged with a young Latina girl of 3 or 4 on his lap, hiding her face in his shirt. Her fine brown hair had all but come loose from 2 long braids down her back, each capped with a pink ribbon, and the matching pink shorts and t-shirt she wore were stained and filthy. The last little boy, a skinny blonde kindergartner with a massive bruise on his forearm, hung back a little from the rest, his hair hanging over his face. They were all looking at her like they expected her to do something.
What is this disgusting place?
Jessica wiped her hands on her shirt and shook out her hair as though it might be full of spiders. She stopped in mid-shake and turned to the kids as though seeing them again for the first time. Her mouth hung open slightly.
You're the kids, she gasped. I mean, you're the kids, the ones that were taken, and you're alive.
She suddenly remembered the mother at the hospital. We have to find that kid and bring him home, Jessica had insisted to John, the words sounding hollow even to her own ears. Now the kids were standing right in front of her.
It's not too late to save you, she thought, filling her with new purpose.
She looked at the little blonde boy.
Are you Jacob?
She asked, her heart fluttering, and his eyes widened in response.
Hey, it's going to be okay, she said,
trying to believe her own words.
I'm Jessica.
None of them answered her right away, instead glancing at one another, trying to reach some silent consensus. Leaving them to it, Jessica stood, surveying their surroundings. It was a dank, brick-walled room with a very low ceiling, so low that Jessica couldn't fully stand upright. The room had exposed pipes along all the walls, some of them giving off plumes of steam. There was a large tank in one corner, probably a hot water heater, and in the far corner was a door. Jessica went to it.
Don't!
The red-headed girl squealed.
It's okay,
Jessica said, trying to make her tone soothing.
I'm going to get us all out of here. Let's just see if it's locked,
she said, hearing her own voice ring out cheerful and hearty. She sounded patronizing. It was a tone she'd always despised in adults when she was a child.
I'll just check,
she said more normally. She walked briskly toward the door.
No!
3 voices cried. Jessica hesitated, then grasped the knob firmly and gave it a twist. Nothing happened. Behind her, one of the children let out a sigh of relief.
It's okay, Jessica said, turning back to them. There's always another way out.
She scanned their anxious, grimy faces.
"What happened here?" she asked.
The boy with the child on his lap looked at her suspiciously.
"Why should we tell you anything? You could be one of them."
"I'm in here same as you," Jessica pointed out.
She dropped down to sit beside him, putting herself on the children's eye level.
"My name is Jessica."
"Ron," he said.
The little girl on his lap tapped his shoulder, and he bent down as she whispered something in his ear.
"Her name's Lisa," he added.
"Alana,"
the redhead said a little too loudly. The blonde boy didn't say anything. Jessica eyed him, but did not ask.
"Hi, Ron, Lisa, Alana, and Jacob,"
Jessica said with excruciating patience.
"Can you tell me what happened?"
"She ate me in her tummy," Lisa whispered.
Instantly, Jessica felt the blood rush from her face.
"You mean the clown girl?"
Jessica asked softly.
"The robot girl?"
The children nodded in unison.
"I was in the woods," Alana said.
She held her hand against her stomach, then mimed the clamp shooting out.
"Chomp,"
she said, her face deadly serious.
"I was riding my bike by my house," Ron said. "There was a woman in the road. She came out of nowhere, and I fell off the bike. I was trying not to hit her."
He gestured to his knees, and Jessica noticed for the first time that they were scabbed over. "He's been here long enough for those to heal," she thought, but held her tongue, afraid if she interrupted he would stop talking altogether.
"When I got up, she was standing over me," Ron continued. "I thought she was trying to help. I told her I was okay, and she smiled, and then..."
He glanced down at the girl on his lap for a moment, then went on.
"I swear, honest, her stomach split right open, and there was this big metal thing that came out of it, and..."
He shook his head.
"She's not going to believe us."
"Did the thing grab you and pull you inside?"
Jessica asked softly, and he looked up at her in surprise.
"Yeah,"
he said.
"Did she get you, too?"
he asked.
"No, but I've seen it happen," she said half-truthfully.
"Then what?"
"I don't know. Next thing I remember, I woke up in here."
"What about her?"
Jessica gestured to the girl on his lap. He shrugged, looking briefly embarrassed.
"As soon as she woke up, she climbed onto my lap."
"Do you know her?"
"You mean from before?"
He looked down at the little girl again.
"No, none of us knew one another before,"
Alana said. Jessica looked at the little blonde boy, and he looked away.
"Okay, well, listen," Jessica said, and they all turned their eyes to her again.
"Creepy, like I'm really a grown-up or something," she thought uneasily. She took a deep breath.
"I've dealt with things like this before."
"Really?"
Alana was suddenly skeptical. Ron watched her warily. Lisa opened one eye, then pressed her face back into Ron's shirt.
"I'm not with them," Jessica said hurriedly. "I'm locked in here with you because I got caught trying to find out more about them."
"Did you know about us?"
Ron asked.
"Not much, but I'm glad that I found you. Everybody's been looking for you. The people who took you, they're trying to hurt a friend of mine. They already have hurt her. And I came here to stop them, to save her from them. Now that I know you're here, I'm going to save you from them too."
"You're locked in here, just like us,"
Alana said, this time like she believed it. Jessica suppressed a smile, momentarily amused.
"I have friends out there, and they're going to help. We're going to get you out of this."
Alana still looked suspicious, but Lisa was peeking at her from behind her hair, loosening her grip on Ron's shirt for the first time.
"I promise you, everything is going to be all right," Jessica said with a surge of confidence.
She looked at the children with calm determination, surprised to realize she had meant every word.
John! Charlie! Carlton burst into John's apartment, the door hitting the wall as it swung open. Marla jumped, sitting up straight on the couch.
Carlton, what's going on?
He didn't respond, scanning the room. Marla was alone. She had the TV on at a low volume. The door to John's room was closed, and he went to it.
No one's here,
Marla said with a hint of disapproval, but Carlton rushed to look inside anyway.
John's not here. Neither is Charlie, Marla called.
Well, I ran into one of them, Carlton said grimly. One of the Charlies, that is. The bad one. Where is John? Where's everyone?
John and Charlie went somewhere. They seemed to be in a hurry and they wouldn't say where they were going.
Jessica?
I haven't seen her. She's probably at home.
I was just at her apartment. She's not there.
Carlton stared at Marla, palpable dread rising between them.
Charlie, the other Charlie, I didn't even hear her come in. She didn't knock or anything. It was like she knew Jessica wouldn't be there.
Wait, shut up,
Marla said suddenly, pointing to the TV.
Marla, this is serious, Carlton said with alarm.
Look at this. They've been playing this commercial all day.
Then the cartoonish face of a little girl, painted like a clown, filled the screen.
Come dressed as a clown and eat for free, said a booming voice.
Then the camera cut to the front of a restaurant.
That's her, Carlton shouted. I mean, the sign, the girl on the sign, the clown girl thing.
Marla leaned forward, squinting at the screen. Carlton stopped, thoughtful for a moment.
She was taller and a little attractive. It was really confusing. So many emotions.
They've been playing these all day. New restaurant, animatronic characters.
It's like the girl on the sign was all grown up and wanted to feed me pizza.
He trailed off.
Carlton!
Marla yelled, snapping him back to the present.
You know where it is? The new place?
He asked.
Yes,
Marla announced. She flipped off the TV and stood.
Let's go.
Carlton looked her grimly up and down, then took the other earpiece out of his pocket.
Put this in your ear, he said. It's all we have. Trust me.
Okay.
Marla snatched the earpiece out of his hand on her way out the door.
I guess you'll fill me in on the way.
Carlton didn't answer as he hurried after her, slamming the door behind them. Chapter 11. As they drove through the ghost town, Charlie could feel John's eyes on her. She had not spoken since they got in the car, and she was beginning to dread the moment she would have to speak again. John made a sharp turn, jostling the car, and she jerked forward in her seat, pressing into the seatbelt.
Sorry, John said sheepishly.
Charlie eased back again.
It's fine, she said with a small smile. I know this might be a strange time to ask, but where is my car?
I'm afraid your doppelganger has your car.
He eyed her nervously, and she forced a crooked smile and nodded.
What would that police report look like, I wonder?
She said lightly, and John grinned. John slowed to a stop, his expression fading.
This is it, he said quietly.
Charlie opened her door and got out. They were at the bottom of a hill. John had stopped beside a narrow archway with a small, metal star at its crest. At the top of the hill was a small house.
Okay, let's get this over with, Charlie said.
She looked around nervously, half expecting someone to come running at them.
Let's go.
As they climbed the hill, John looked several times like he wanted to say something, but did not. When they reached the front porch, Charlie put a hand on his arm.
So, she's still in there? She asked. Jen, I mean.
He nodded.
Yeah. At least, I think so. Are you sure you want to do this?
I have to.
I'll go in first, he offered. I can cover her up if you want me to.
He looked at her, distressed. Charlie hesitated.
No, she said finally, and grasped the knob firmly.
The door wasn't locked, and Charlie scanned the room apprehensively as she entered. The place was in disarray. Everything blended into everything else, and at first nothing stood out. Then they saw her. There was a woman in the corner, by the hallway. She was huddled against the wall, curled over herself, and her dark hair hung thickly over her face. Charlie heard a sharp intake of breath, then realized it was her own. She held a hand out stiffly behind her, unable to say in words what she needed, but John saw and took her hand, stepping close behind her.
That's really her?
Yeah, he whispered. Did you want to get closer?
John asked uncertainly. Charlie shook her head.
No, it's not her anymore, she whispered, turning away, closing it off in her mind.
She took a deep breath.
Where did you find me?
She gestured to herself to make sure John knew which Charlie she meant.
That way.
John led her to the hallway, keeping wide of Jen's slumped body. Charlie forced herself not to look directly at her, allowing herself to see only a dark, hunched shape in the corner of her eye as she passed. At the end of the hall was the open door to a storage room, filled with trunks and cardboard boxes. The window was open, and it was not until she breathed fresh air that Charlie noticed the damp, moldy smell that had taken over the rest of the house.
This one, John said.
He was standing beside a large green trunk, its lids standing open.
In here?
Charlie said bleakly, stepping over several boxes to get to him. She peered inside. There was a small pillow, and nothing else.
I was just in there? She asked, somehow disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, Jen must have had a reason. She must have known about the imposter. Maybe she put you there just before we arrived.
Charlie reached out and closed the trunk.
I want to look around.
What are we looking for?
John asked, and she shrugged, opening another trunk.
Anything, she said. If there's anything useful, this is where it will be. We need to know what we're up against.
They searched in silence for a while. None of the boxes were labeled, and Charlie opened them haphazardly, sifting quickly through the ones containing paperwork, and setting aside the others unexamined. Those contained random assortments of household items, dishes and silverware, knick-knacks Charlie recognized from childhood, even some of her old toys. She scanned a box of Jen's tax documents carefully, then replaced them, finding nothing that seemed to stand out. She reached for another box, then saw John giving her a funny look.
What?
She asked. He smiled, and there was a hint of something sad beyond it.
You read really fast, was all he said.
Didn't anyone ever teach you how to speed read?
She said briefly, then turned her attention elsewhere. Charlie abandoned the stack of boxes she had been going through and went to the far corner of the room. She shoved a precarious pile of neatly folded sheets and towels aside and sat down cross-legged on the carpet. From here, she could not even see John, though she could hear him, shuffling through paper and muttering to himself under his breath. She swept her eyes up and down the stacks, one after another. Then she saw it. Henry, written in her aunt's careful script. Charlie moved 3 overcoats and another box, and then it was in her hands. She stared at the lettering for a long moment. The ink had faded over the years. Charlie traced it with her index finger, her pulse fluttering in her throat like her heart was trying to get out. "Daddy." She opened the box and saw it. On top was an old green plaid flannel shirt, worn down as thin and soft as cotton. She picked it up as if it were something delicate and pressed it to her face, inhaling through the fiber. It only smelled like dust and thyme, but the touch of the fabric on her face brought tears to her eyes. She breathed in and out slowly, trying to force them back, and finally regained her composure, though part of her howled out the unfairness of it, that she could not even take a moment to cling to his slight presence and mourn. Self-consciously, Charlie put the shirt over her shoulders, letting it drape over her back as she leaned once more over the box. The rest of the box was stacked with smaller boxes, and she opened the first one to find a framed picture of herself with Sammy, infants in those few, precious years before everything was ripped apart. Under the picture was an envelope, addressed in her father's handwriting, to Jenny. Charlie smiled and shook her head. "I can't imagine anyone calling Aunt Jen Jenny." She opened the letter.
"My dearest Jenny, I had an entire list of instructions written out for you. Schedules and timetables, keys and procedures. You have indulged me so much, and it's only now, at the end, that I see how it has helped me get through these dark times, but also how ultimately empty it has been. I had everything so carefully planned. I've worked so tirelessly. I've warped and twisted my surroundings to the point where I can never be sure if I've completely settled back into reality. And even if I did manage to turn off everything planted in the walls to deceive myself, I think my mind would deceive me still. I don't need clinical testing of the long-term effects of these devices to know that I've undoubtedly done permanent damage to myself. I will always see what I want to see, but worse than that, there is the splinter, more like the stake, always deep into my heart, reminding me more and more every day that what I see is a lie. Through your patience and your indulgence of me, you've tried to keep me happy, but it's also somehow brought me back from this world I've made for myself. I think maybe it would have been better for you to have not indulged me. Then I could have excluded you from my bubble, convinced myself that you were crazy like everyone else. But instead, your unceasing love caused me to listen to you, to let you in, and the consequence of that was seeing the truth in your eyes, and letting that in as well. I have my Charlie here with me. You will never have to indulge me in her again. Rather than taking joy in her, I have cried over her, so many countless tears. I have poured agony into her, until she serves as another reminder not of what I once had, but of the unbearable pain of what was taken from me. She has come to reflect my pain back to me, whereas I, for a time, took great comfort in her eyes. I now only see loss, endless, debilitating loss. Her eyes will never fill me again. In fact, they have emptied me. Keep all the closets shut. Let them be tombs for my denial and my grievance. My only lasting instruction for you concerns the 4th closet. It is not enough to keep it shut. You must keep that one sealed and buried. My grief was already beginning to waken me to reality when I began what was to be her final stage. When I rose, slightly, from the depth of my despair, I saw that I had no choice but to cease my work, for I was only feeding my own delusion. My old faithful partner, who I can only hope now is in a grave of his own, took what I had begun and made something of his own, something dreadful. He crafted my beloved work into something of his own, and endowed it with who knows what kinds of evil. I was able to stop him, and to seal away what he made, and you, Jenny, must ensure that the seal remains. I would instruct you to demolish the house if I could trust that it could be done effectively. Keep it, and make sure the world forgets it. Then, someday, after many decades have passed and no one remembers, fill it with every kind of flammable thing and burn it to the ground, standing close guard to put a bullet into anything that emerges from the rubble, no matter what or who it looks like. I'm going to be with my daughter. Love always, and to the end, Henry. Charlie? John was standing behind her. Wordlessly, she held the pages out to him. He took them, and she moved aside the box the letter had been in and stared down at the next one. It was sealed with packing tape, but the sticky side was old and dry, the edges curling up from the cardboard. John shuffled the pages, still reading. Charlie shivered, despite the warm air, and she put her arms through the sleeves of her father's shirt and rolled them up to her elbows.
"Do you know what it means?" John asked quietly.
Charlie looked up at him and shook her head.
"Scoot over," he said with a small smile, and she did, making room for him in the little space among the boxes.
He sat down facing her, crossing his legs awkwardly. He handed the pages back to her, and she scanned them again.
"What did he mean about the closets?" John said.
"I don't know," Charlie said dryly.
"Think," John protested. "It has to mean something."
"I don't know," Charlie repeated. "You were there. They were always empty, except the one with Ella."
"You don't know that," John said softly. "There was one that was locked," he continued, almost to himself.
"It doesn't matter, does it?" Charlie said. "The house is gone. Unless you feel like digging through more rubble, this is all we have."
She pried the box with the peeling tape out of the larger box and handed it to him. All that was left under it was a lockbox, which opened easily when she tugged at the lid. It, too, was filled with papers. On top was a fine pencil drawing of a familiar face.
"That's Ella," John said, peering over her shoulder.
"Yeah," Charlie said. Her father had captured the doll's delicate features in exquisite detail, not only her face, but her shiny, synthetic hair and the tiny creases in her dark, starched dress. Her eyes were open wide, and their blank stare was at odds with the rest of the picture. A perfectly lifelike representation of something lifeless.
"I didn't realize he was such an artist," John said, and Charlie smiled.
"He said he drew things so he could see them, that it didn't work the other way around."
She handed John the picture. Below it was another, again of Ella, this time from the side. The next showed only Ella's face, in profile.
"He made Ella, right?"
John asked, and Charlie tilted her head, considering the drawing. Charlie sorted through the rest of the pile more quickly and shook her head, confused.
"They're all of Ella."
John picked up the remaining cardboard box and ripped the tape off with sound like tearing cloth. It stuck to his fingers as he balled it up, and from the corner of her eye, Charlie saw him struggling to dislodge it. She paged through the drawings again.
"Look at the notes."
She handed him the first drawing they had looked at, growing impatient as he peered at her father's meticulous,
but tiny handwriting. He read it out slowly.
Height, 81 centimeters, head circumference.
He looked up.
It's just measurements.
Charlie handed him another drawing.
Looks the same to me, John said, then flicked his eyes to the notations. Height, 118 centimeters.
John tilted the page as though he might be reading it wrong.
This one says 164.5, Charlie said, holding up another, seemingly identical picture. I don't understand, she said, setting the page in her lap. Did he make another Ella? She traced a finger along the line of Ella's hair, smudging the pencil mark. Then a thought struck her. I wonder if he was trying to make it up to me, she said.
What do you mean?
If he was trying to give me a companion, a friend, because of what happened.
She met John's eyes, unable to say what she really meant.
You mean Sammy? Because you lost your twin, he wanted to give you a doll that would, what, grow up with you?
John said incredulously, and she nodded, relieved that he had made sense of her half-spoken words.
Maybe, Charlie said softly. His eyes were pinched with worry, and he looked away, studying the drawings in his hands again. It doesn't really make sense, though, does it? Charlie said. What would I do with a 5.5-foot doll on a track? She reached for the letter again, holding it like a talisman, though she did not need to read from it. Was there a bigger version of Ella in the locked closet? John's eyes searched the air without a target in the silent room for several long moments, then snapped back to attention. Charlie was quietly looking down at her own hand, slowly curling her fingers, then uncurling them. The silence dragged on, smothering. Then John grabbed Charlie's hand, startling her.
I saw your blood.
What?
Charlie said, startled.
I saw your blood that night. You bled. I don't think Ella bleeds, do you?
The statement was absurd, but John was watching her uneasily, as if he expected a response. Seconds passed, and Charlie did not know what to say.
I thought you were dead that night, John whispered at last.
But I'm not dead, right? She locked eyes with John. I'm alive, right?
She took his hand, and he grasped hers tightly. He covered her hand in both his own, and she gave him a puzzled smile.
John? She repeated nervously, and his jaw tightened. He looked on the point of speaking when Charlie suddenly turned her head toward the window.
What is it?
John said with alarm.
Charlie put a finger to her lips and tilted her head to listen.
There's someone outside.
John watched her face intently, then his eyes widened as he registered the sound too. The footsteps crunched one last time on the gravel outside, then were silent.
Around back, he mouthed,
and Charlie nodded, dropping his hands and steadying herself on the trunk behind her as she stood. John hastened to help her, but she waved him off.
Come on, she whispered. Back door?
I don't know.
He started to make his way toward the hall, motioning her to follow.
Charlie, hurry.
John had doubled back to her and was pointing urgently to the door. She shoved the letter into her back pocket and followed him, picking her way cautiously through the debris of the storage room. In the hallway, the thick and musty air hit like a wave, and Charlie swallowed her revulsion, trying not to picture her aunt's body curled up in the next room. They crept down the hallway toward the front room and the door, shuffling their feet so as to make no noise. At the end of the hall, John stopped, and Charlie waited, listening. There was only silence. Then a wind chime rattled outside the front door, and they pulled back into the recess of the hall. John looked grim, There. He nodded to the door opposite the storage room, which was slightly ajar. Was that open before?